The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
68 as a year and all these sort of struggles so unique, I think, was the fact that it was probably the first time and probably the only time since then that really you had this kind of intense sort of revolutionary upsurge truly happening on a global scale. And of course there's a lot of attention that, especially living in the US, that's put on what happened was happening in the US and what was happening in Western Europe and in sort of the major capitalist centers. But also these were struggles that were taking place in the ostensibly communist world in places like Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia, and particularly in the Third World, or what was known then or thought of then as the Third World. Latin America, Africa, Asia, a lot of places that had recently come out of colonial rule. And what I think is so important about what's happening in 1968 is that the Third World was not in any way sort of peripheral to the struggles around the globe anywhere, in the sense that the struggle of the Vietnamese people against US imperialism, the impact of the Cuban Revolution, the impact of the Cultural Revolution in China, and the impact of African liberation struggles that were taking place in 1968 all had a profound impact on the radicalization that was taking place in the West. And at the same time, I think it's important, and I'll touch a little bit on this in the talk, to remember that the events that were happening in the West and in the Soviet bloc also had a huge impact on what was happening in the Third World. And that it was actually incredibly important that struggles were happening in these sort of centers of power and centers of sort of neo-colonial influence in Africa. And it created the feeling of a weight sort of being lifted off of a lot of people in Africa who were struggling for something very different in the 1960s. And so I think the way that these struggles around the globe kind of talked to each other and really sort of, whether intentionally or not, ended up supporting each other is an important reason why we need to look at what was happening truly all over the world in 1968. And I'm very honored that I get to speak a little bit about what was happening in Africa during this time period. So the first thing I want to talk about is just sort of what in general is the context in 1968 in Africa. And if people look at the handout that hopefully everybody got, you can see one of the things that is important to the context for Africa in 1968 is that most of Africa, although not all, and that's important, but most of Africa had gone from being colonies, European colonies, particularly under the French, the British, the Belgians, to becoming independent nation states in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And by 1968, there were already a number of questions that were very explosive, and I'm not gonna talk directly into this mic because the pitches are driving me a little crazy, so I'm gonna move a little bit away from the mic to keep talking. Okay, we're back. So the first issue that I think was so important was the issue of real independence. And I use that term because it was a term used by a lot of African activists in the 1960s. And it was counterposed to what was seen as sort of the limitations of formal independence, or the failure of formal independence to actually cast aside the colonial institutions and structures in society that had existed for the decades prior. And so what did that mean? What was this sort of lack of real independence? The first thing it meant was that there had been a very strong imperial influence on the process of decolonization itself. And so the imperial powers had worked very hard to put sort of, to foster new African leaders that were very amenable to sort of continuing the kind of colonial relationships that had that existed before independence. But it wasn't just about sort of people. It was also about the way that colonial institutions continued to operate in a very concrete way after independence. This is probably the most profound and the most obvious in the economic sphere, right? So under colonial rule, essentially European companies dominated in all of the sort of major fronts of import-export of commodities in and out of Africa. All of the whatever industrialization had been sort of allowed in Africa was completely under European hands. The banking and finance system was under European hands. And in many places, actually, the currency reserves and the reserves that were made from sort of selling commodities, agricultural commodities on this international market, were being held in banks in Europe. And after independence, those things did not, that general dynamic did not change. That continued to be the case. The other thing was that militarily, the new African militaries that were being formed after independence were still completely reliant on the aid and on the training of those militaries by the former colonial powers as well. And not just that, but many countries, particularly in the former French colonies, maintained a military bases of the former colonial power. And that actually becomes important in some places in 1968. And the last thing I want to talk about in terms of this question of sort of the lack of real independence was the issue of education. And this was particularly important for a lot of African students in 1968. Colonial rule had infamously allowed very little space for formal education under colonialism. And there was a strong push in the anti-colonial movements to really expand education. But after independence, even as there was this push to expand, there was also at the same time a continued reliance on European teachers, administrators. They still dominated, especially in higher education, all of the deans, the proctors, or not the, I forgot all the different terms in different colonial sort of trajectories, but all of the sort of people in positions of authority tended to be European, almost down the line, across the continent. And the curricula were still European curriculum. So people still learned European history. They did not learn African history, for example. And there was this, by 1968, there was this sort of bubbling anger really across the continent about the limits of the education system and what hadn't changed. So there's this question of real independence. The other question I think is so huge in Africa in 1968 is the question of democracy. By 1968, across almost all of the continent where countries had become independent, colonies had become independent, the single party state was really the dominant form of government. And what that means, people can probably guess from the name, but what it meant was that essentially there was only one legal party and that it was closely integrated into the organs of the state. And there were a number of reasons for why these came about. I think one of the sort of crudest reasons is that in some ways it was an inheritance of colonial rule, which is to say that under colonial rule there was certainly no space for really democratic debate and dissent. Not until the very late stages of colonial rule even were African political parties allowed to form, were Africans allowed to form trade unions and go on strike. And so colonial rule had systematically sort of suppressed democratic discussion, debate, politics. And so the fact that after independence, a lot of African countries were organized around sort of very undemocratic single party states was in part a reflection of this legacy. But there were also very concrete reasons why new African leaders adopted that. And one of those reasons was that they also inherited these colonies that had been carved out by Europeans without any regard for sort of the way different populations connected across those borders. Colonial powers had often played different sections of the population off against one another. And so when African leaders sort of inherit these colonies, they're in a position of trying to sort of create a unified nation. And there were certainly, and we'll talk, I can mention it later, there's certainly people who are thinking beyond the sort of limitations of the nation and thinking about sort of what would a truly kind of Pan-African vision for post-independence Africa be. But for the most part, the immediate sort of task in front of them was the consolidation of nations that had never been nations before. And so for a lot of African leaders, what that sort of drove them to was this idea of needing to create sort of a big tent, one single legal party that everyone had to sort of be contained within. And a lot of that was around sort of kind of creating or almost kind of forcing a certain sort of unity to sort of hold the nation together. But what that meant in practice was that there was no real space for sort of autonomous or independent politics. And so what you start to see very quickly in the early 1960s is that opposition parties, trade unions, religious groups, student organizations that are independent of that single party state are all sort of systematically repressed and brought sort of under the wing of that. And the last issue that I think was particularly explosive in 1968 was the question of socialism. And there are a few reasons for this, but what I think is important to sort of remember is that decolonization in the 50s and 60s is happening during the Cold War. And so at the time, there's a clear association between colonialism and capitalism, right? The major colonial powers were all sort of Western European capitalist powers. And so my son is here. And so given that, not surprisingly, a lot of African anti-colonial leaders had been very attracted to ideas of communism, ideas of Marxism, as a way to sort of undo the sort of the damage and exploitation of colonialism. And a lot of them became very active in communist parties in Europe. They became very active in communist networks, traveling to China and to Vietnam and other parts of the communist world at that time. But at the same time, when they found themselves faced with the prospect of actually coming into leading an independent country, they were also very wary of getting pulled into either of the Cold War's spheres. They had obviously experienced 70 years of colonialism or more under one set of dominating powers, and were wary about that being sort of replicated, whether under the U.S. or under the Soviet Union or any particular sort of Cold War bloc. And so what came out of that was really this idea of the third world. And that was not just, this was not just a challenge faced by new African leaders, but really leaders throughout the world that had been, that came out of colonial rule. And I think that, you know, the third world movement was really about sort of trying to create something outside of the Cold War blocs that could be a mutually beneficial and mutually supportive relationship between these new nations. And what that translated to in Africa was really kind of this idea of African socialism. And African socialism, what it was about, and I should just say sort of the scope of it, which is that, or the scale of it, which is about two dozen countries after in the 1960s in Africa adopted some version of African socialism as a sort of official policy of the government. And what the vision of African socialism was in most cases was kind of an amalgam of different ideas. So Marxism was one part of it. Another part of it was the idea of sort of traditional communal African values. And a third part of it was also interestingly sort of Christian or Islamic values, depending on the place. And so these were sort of meant to kind of create something that was going to be a sort of distinctly African approach to the question of eradicating the inequalities of capitalism. But also not sort of necessarily aligning themselves with the communist bloc. And I'll talk more about sort of what the fundamental tenets of African socialism were. But in 1968, what was starting to happen was that young people in particular, but also trade unionists and all kinds of working class people in Africa, were starting to become disillusioned with the prospects and the promise of African socialism. And were starting to look for something that they felt like needed to be a more radical vision for Africa moving ahead. So I had this grandiose idea that I was going to talk about five examples of mass uprisings that were happening in Africa in 1968. And that is would take far too long for me to really do that. But I made the packets before I realized that was not at all realistic. So the packets actually have pictures, and you can see on the front on the map the different countries that I had proposed that I would cover, which are Congo Brazzaville, Senegal, Guinea-Bissau, Egypt, and Tanzania. And I can talk briefly about maybe all of them, but I'll only talk in detail about probably about two of them. Did you get a handout?
No, I've just got here.
Oh, okay. Is there another handout left? Okay, cool. People can also look on and share, so. So what I want to do, not all of these struggles I'm talking about are sort of fully contained in the year 1968, because I think, as we sort of know from American history, right, it's important to sort of think of 68 as kind of a moment that was really part of sort of the apex of a larger kind of period of struggle from about 1965 to 1975, and that's true in Africa as well. And so with that in mind, the first case I wanted to talk about was Congo Brazzaville. And you can see from your packet in the first pages, I've got some pictures from there. It's a place I've spent a lot of time doing research on this particular topic. And Congo Brazzaville is sort of a quintessential case, you could say, of the way that a new African government could kind of be put in place without having fundamentally changed any of the colonial relationships that it was coming out of. Fulbert Yulu, who was the first president of Congo Brazzaville, was you know, a notorious sort of anti-communist, very much sort of pro-maintaining a relationship with France that did not disrupt the way the status quo, and very much sort of moved quickly to create a single party state in Congo-Brazzaville. But when he tried to do that, interestingly, what happened was that he felt very confident through a long period, through many years of sort of repressing his opponents and co-opting them into his government, that he was on a sure footing for creating a single party, for starting a single party state. But in that process, the government had actually become extremely alienated from the population as a whole, and was seen as leading extremely extravagant lifestyles, being far too cozy with foreign business leaders, doing little to really expand education and housing that was desperately needed in Congo's urban areas. And so in 1963, when he proposes a single party state, there's all of a sudden this sort of explosion of activity that's centered around Congo's trade unions. And at the time, he was very much, the trade unions were kind of the last bastion that he had been unable to sort of bring into the single party state and suppress. And so in 1963, the trade unions called demonstrations against the proposal to create a single party state in Congo. And immediately it provokes this sort of urban uprising. It draws out tons of people far beyond the trade unions' membership themselves. And in 3 days of these protests, which you can see some pictures of in the packet, the government and really the entire political establishment is forced to resign. And so you have just a complete emptying out of the Congolese sort of political elite. And into this vacuum actually steps a group of young, all people in their 20s, only about two dozen of them, but sort of young, sort of left-leaning intellectuals. And they begin to sort of put forth a vision of revolution in Congo. And they organize around a bunch of different ways that you can see in those pictures. One is that they create these mass youth organizations. Congo did not have, had a very tiny education. There were three high schools in the entire country in 1968. I mean, this is the legacy of colonialism, right? So instead of just organizing around students, they really organized sort of all kind of young people under the age of 25 in the cities into these mass sort of independent youth organizations. They started a newspaper called Dipanda, which meant independence in Lingala, that became the most widely read newspaper in the country. They started having these mass meetings on Sunday mornings that were basically sort of Marxist education meetings, but also meetings about all kinds of things around women's oppression, sort of the basic history of sort of Congo and Congolese people, things that were not actually available to people through the formal education system. And through this process, there's tens of thousands of young people who are sort of brought into politics. And what happens is that during this process, a lot of these sort of young intellectuals get thrown into positions of state authority in the sort of new post-revolutionary government. And from those positions, they actually enact a lot of the kind of changes around real independence that people had been calling for. So for example, they kick out French troops. So the French troops are expelled from the country in 1965. Shortly after that, they nationalized the education system, which up to that point was still completely run by missionaries and by foreign administrators. They nationalized the two foreign-owned utilities that provide all of the water and electricity for Congo-Brazzaville. And they really turned Brazzaville, the capital of Congo, into this hub for sort of leftist movements from around Central Africa. And like I said, what was so brilliant about sort of what was happening in Congo is that literally tens of thousands of young people by 1968 were sort of brought into kind of this revolutionary process and were really sort of put in a position of actually having say in the direction of the country in a way that had never really happened since, or hadn't really happened since the anti-colonial movements of the 1950s. And so I want to just kind of pause there. I'm going to talk about another example, but I wanted, should I pause there? Maybe I'll keep going, actually. Okay. How are people feeling? I was thinking of actually pausing at a moment to give people a little bit of a break, but I guess I'll keep going for a little bit. I'm getting a lot of thumbs up. So while all this is happening in Congo, other struggles are starting to break out also around this question of real independence. And the next example that I'd want to talk about was the example of Senegal. And Senegal in in 1968 bore a lot of similarities to Congo-Brazzaville before the revolution there, in the sense that under President Leopold Senghor, you essentially had a similar dynamic of sort of independence without decolonization, right? The French still had a military base there. The economy was still very much in European hands. The head of the Dakar Chamber of Commerce, the most important sort of economic body in the country, was still ruled over by a Frenchman. The University of Dakar was not just which was the only university that the French had actually set up in their sub-Saharan African colonies. The University of Dakar was not just sort of French in the way it was run and its curriculum. It was literally a French university still in 1968. It still gave out French university system diplomas. And so you really had the situation where for a lot of people it felt like things had not really changed. And Senghor, like a lot of his counterparts, had really by 1968 sort of consolidated power around himself and his single party. And by 1968 there was this kind of imminent crisis that had been bubbling up for quite some time. Wages had not been raised in a decade, literally since colonial rule. The cost of living by this time was skyrocketing. There was an agricultural drought. There was a drop in the world market for the prices paid for Senegal's most important export at the time, which was groundnuts. The university, like I said, was still a French institution, and secondary students couldn't actually find jobs. So there was this expansion of people who were graduating from high school, but they couldn't actually find jobs, and in part because a lot of the teaching and administrative positions in the private sector were still held by Europeans. And again, because the political system under single party rule didn't allow for the expression of opposition to sort of come out through opposition parties and things like that, it became this sort of explosive thing that came out through organizations that were trying to sort of resist being co-opted into the state. And in Senegal, it wasn't the trade unions, but it was actually the students at the University of Dakar that led that struggle. And you can see, I won't get into all the details of what happens, but the students go out on strike in 1968, and immediately there's a very violent reaction from the police that's very actually similar to a lot of the tactics that were used at Columbia University in 1968. It's very uncanny, actually, the sort of the violence and the way it plays out. But it triggers a real urban uprising throughout the capital city of Dakar. The trade unions, which were officially sort of under the single party state, basically break free of it, declare a general strike and shut down the city as well as a couple of other smaller cities. And what you have basically is this moment where the entire Senegalese government looks like it might fall the same way that the Congolese government had a few years earlier. And what's so important, I think, to this and also to what happened in Congo is that even though there was sort of little space for kind of independent political organization, there was this important thread of organized Marxists in Senegal that had organized under something that was called the African Independence Party since the 1950s. It was an illegal party. It had banned, people had just experienced electroshock, torture at the hands of Senegalese authorities. People had been jailed for decades. Some of them were still sitting in prison in 1968. But nonetheless, this Marxist party had managed to, despite all of that, continue to sort of train students and younger people in sort of ideas of revolutionary Marxism. And when that strike broke out in 1968, it was this actually very tiny core of Marxist organizers that wrote the pamphlets that actually called for the strike to be an open-ended strike and not a short-term strike, that actually had the connections to the trade unions that eventually led to the trade unions coming out in the general strike. And so as small as they were, actually their influence was quite big. And so the other thing that I want to talk about this May of 68 moment was also that, so in the midst of all this going on, President Senghor is literally goes into hiding. No one knows where he is for a couple days. It seems like the government might collapse. But then Senghor gets on the radio and he gives this whole speech and he blames the students. He says, you'd tell me that I'm the neo-colonialist, but you're the one mimicking the students in France who are out in 1968. You're the one following them and just trying to be like them. And it was a completely sort of cynical ploy on his part, and it was all about kind of trying to split the students from the workers who were out on strike. And in some ways, it wasn't ineffective in a certain kind of way. But and students, and former participants who I've interviewed quite a few of, have always been very clear that this would have happened regardless of what was happening in France. And I really do think that that's absolutely true. This this outbreak of struggle would have happened regardless. There was no sort of mimicry of European students. But I think what's actually important and what gets lost in that kind of very polarized debate is the fact that I actually think what was happening simultaneously in France was actually crucially important, because it, like I said at the very beginning of my talk, it actually, students in Senegal saw France as the power that was sort of behind Senghor, right? That was the power that was standing in the way of sort of winning these demands for real independence. And so when the regime in France looked like it could crumble, or that it could be weakened, that it could be really sort of, the legs could be kicked out from under Charles de Gaulle, then it sort of seemed like, well, that would make it much easier for us to actually challenge Senghor. And not just Senghor, but the University of Dakar had students from all over the former French colonies. And a lot of them looked back to their own countries and said, the weaker France is, the more we can actually change about our countries back home. And so I think that actually it had a huge impact, and I want to, you know, again sort of emphasize how these sort of struggles are impacted, and that it was a great weight that was kind of lifted off, and I think in many ways an inspiration for students in Senegal. And in response, Senghor The flip side of that is that the government in France did not crumble in 1968. De Gaulle did remain in power, and that becomes important because when push comes to shove, what does Senghor do to restore order and to sort of crush the strike? Well, he calls on the French to bring in those French troops that are still based in Senegal. And so without the backing of French troops to crush that strike in Senegal in 1968, Senghor may quite possibly have not been able to sort of hold on to power. And so the fact that in 1968 the French government did not fall also had a negative impact on the outcome in Senegal. That I think is important to remember. But he was forced to actually grant a number of really important concessions along the lines of these sort of demands for real independence. Certainly workers' wages, the minimum wage was increased by 15%, which was huge. Workers also won pensions and healthcare benefits for the first time. Students maintained their scholarships, which he had been threatening to cut, which had sort of prompted the strike in the first place. And the university finally became basically a Senegalese institution. After 1968, for the first time, the president of the university became a Senegalese person. There were all these sort of changes that happened in the university to make it more of a sort of African and Senegalese institution because of the 68 strike and the strikes. There were a number of strikes in the years that followed. And it also resulted in the reopening of politics. And Senghor was very savvy about sort of keeping control of it, but it was really 68 kind of marked the end of the single party state, and he was forced to sort of reintroduce space for opposition parties to develop. So I want to just kind of take a quick break right there. I will talk for a little while longer, but I've thrown a lot of information at people, and I just want to sort of repeat what we did at the beginning, which is just to give people sort of 2 minutes to kind of stop having to listen to me for a minute, chat with your neighbor about kind of what kind of questions or thoughts you have coming out of that, and things that you might want to share in the discussion that we have later. So just take a little break right there. I'm going to keep going. But I wanted to just create a little space there. So I wanted to, with the time I have left, I want to talk about one other example and then some sort of closing thoughts. And I think the example that I'll choose is Tanzania, because I sort of talked about two examples that reflected, I guess you could say, a situation where there was no question that sort of the government and powers seemed to many young people and to many working class people as an impediment to really sort of winning real independence. But I want to also talk about, there were also places, and they were smaller in number, where new governments actually were making a very concerted effort to sort of challenge the lingering impact of colonial institutions. And the two that I was going to talk about were Egypt and Tanzania, and I don't have time to talk about them both, although I'm happy to talk more about Egypt in the discussion. I'm going to focus on Tanzania right now. Because in 1968, the president of Tanzania, Julius Nyerere, was very much in a different place than somebody like Fulbert Yolu or Leopold Senghor. He was very much seen internationally, and certainly in Africa, as sort of the icon of African socialism. And he was the first president, and along with people like Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana and Sekou Toure in Guinea, had really been sort of one of the main kind of purveyors of the ideas of African socialism. And a big part of the ideas of African socialism, of course, were about the need for African unity as a means to combat imperialism and neocolonialism in Africa. And Nyerere, like his counterparts, critiqued the capitalist changes that had been brought about by colonial rule, instead argued that traditional African society, and those are his words, and African notions of familyhood, or the word in Kiswahili was ujamaa, provided a natural model for modern socialism. And this was true of the other sort of main purveyors of African socialism. Now, interestingly, for Nyerere, and this is true of early Nkrumah as well, socialism in post-colonial Africa would not be based on class struggle, at least not class struggle within the new African countries. Rather, as he said it himself, quote, true socialism is an attitude of the mind. It was born of a personal commitment to certain values, unity, hard work, and the selflessness that he believed kind of animated life before colonial rule. And so in his mind, or at least in his writings, I don't know what was in his mind, but in his writings, he really portrays sort of exploitation and oppression as sort of a relationship that takes place between individuals, right? So you know, as he says in his writings, you know, workers can be capitalists if they demand too much. At the same time, millionaires can be socialists if they give that wealth to the people. So it was really sort of about kind of people's personal values. But what that meant in practice was that, you know, he disparaged groups like organized trade union workers in Tanzania who had fought to improve their standard of living under colonial rule, had fought for higher wages and for better benefits. Because now in post-colonial Africa, he said, you know, they're sort of taking too much of a chunk of the share of the national wealth. At the same time, he very much railed against what he saw as sort of idlers, gossip, drunkenness, dancing, anything that sort of pulled away from an ethos of hard work. And so in the Arusha Declaration, which is one of the sort of main documents of African socialism in Tanzania, he writes, the biggest requirement for development is hard work. Let us go to the villages and talk to our people and see whether or not it is possible for them to work harder. In towns, for example, wage earners normally work 7.5 or 8 hours a day for 6 or 6.5 days a week. In a country like ours, these are really quite short working hours. In other countries, even in those that are more developed than we are, people work for more than 45 hours a week. It's not normal for a young country to start with such a short working week. The normal thing is to begin with long working hours and decrease them as the country becomes more and more prosperous. And so there's these kind of tensions where, on the one hand, Nkrumah's vision is about sort of socialism and is about sort of creating prosperity for Africans, but then what he's kind of requiring from people out of that is an incredible amount of sort of labor. And so what did this kind of African socialism look like in practice? I mean, it was also organized around a single party state. But with attempts to sort of develop industrialization by attracting foreign investment and aid. And it was, you could say, like a lot of models of African socialism, it was basically kind of a form of capitalist development. Capitalist development under state planning is really what it was. And it was a genuine attempt to sort of create local industry, to diversify agriculture, to really be able to sort of compete on a global market, not for dominance or hegemony, but simply to not continue to be sort of overwhelmed by Western imports, be overwhelmed by Western finance, and to really sort of reshape the economy to serve local needs instead of foreign needs. And Nyerere talks a lot about sort of the government needing to be a government of peasants and workers, and about the means of production needing to be in the hands of peasants and workers. And in 1967, he sort of moves more in that direction. He actually says, you know what, with the Arusha Declaration, he says, we're not going to rely on foreign aid for our development anymore. foreign aid has been absolutely too fickle, too unreliable, has had too many strings attached for us to actually be able to sort of move ahead with our industrialization and our modernization of agriculture. And so what he does is he nationalizes all of the banks in the country, all of the British banks. He nationalizes the seven sort of major corporations, European corporations that run the Tanzanian economy. But the main shift that happens alongside that is his shift towards what he calls self-reliance. And what that entailed was a refocusing of energy away from the cities and onto the countryside. And specifically what he wanted to do was really make the countryside sort of the driver of capital accumulation in Tanzania. And so his model for that was to essentially create what were called Ujamaa villages, to relocate the very dispersed, or fairly dispersed compared to a lot of places in Africa, population in Tanzania, into more sort of centralized collective villages. And his model for this was actually China's Great Leap Forward and the forced collectivization in China in 1958 to 1960. Now, I mean, we can look back and say, well, that was absolutely a disaster. 30 to 50 million people died in the famines created by the Chinese Great Leap Forward. But what I think Nyerere took out of it, right afterwards, was that this was a model of sort of hard work, actually being able to overcome the material conditions of inequality that had been bred by colonialism. And so for Nyerere, the Ujamaa village system was the way out of this sort of reliance on foreign capital and the domination of foreign capital. But it was not something that was up for debate. And so when you had, initially it was meant to be sort of democratic, it was meant to be voluntary, but when people didn't want to actually move to these Ujamaa villages, it became very much a coerced, forced, militarized operation. And so you have this real sort of shift by 1968 already, where already he's starting to ban what had actually been the model for Ujamaa villages, which was the Rovuma Development Association, which was an autonomous attempt to sort of collectivize agriculture between a number of villages. And unfortunately, what that meant for Nyerere was that was a model of collectivization that couldn't be controlled by the state, that couldn't be sort of worked into the national development plans, and so it had to be actually banned in 1969 by the government. And so this turn to coercion, and I think this is true, this was also true in Nkrumah's Ghana, which is that this turn towards coercion and sort of having to force sort of development through a very top-down state planning kind of method essentially sort of sapped the sort of enthusiasm and energy out of the people who are supposed to be the ones working hard. And so you have this inherent sort of thing where there's this constant spiral of the government complaining that people are apathetic, people are not sort of fulfilling the needs of this sort of wonderful socialist vision. And really the big reason behind that is that people had no motivate, there was nothing sort of in it for them. They had no real control over the conditions of what those Ujamaa villages were going to look like. And so people more and more, it becomes more and more this coercive kind of system. The whole program eventually collapses, and by the early 1970s, Tanzania is actually more reliant on food aid than it had been before the Ujamaa experiment. Now my goal had been, and I don't know if I really have time, but I will press Akuna to give me a little bit of time, to talk about sort of the response to African socialism in Tanzania in 1968 and around 1968. Arusha kind of prompted this a sort of left at the University of Dar es Salaam, which was the only university in Tanzania at the time, started right after independence, and a group was formed in 1967 called the University Students African Revolutionary Front, and it had a few dozen students. Who joined at first, and the group never really grew beyond maybe say 50 students on campus, but it actually had a very profound effect on the direction of Tanzanian politics. And it was very much inspired by the kind of people who were coming to Tanzania because of what Nyerere was saying about socialism. So Walter Rodney, the Guyanese revolutionary, was there at the University of Dar es Salaam talking for a long time, teaching for a while, but also Angela Davis came through to give a talk, C.L.R. James came through to give a talk, Samir Amin was there for a while, and so there was this real sort of left-wing ferment at the university, and the USARF, the African Revolutionary Front on campus, started a newspaper that was called Cheche, which meant spark in Kiswahili, and that was, of course, a reference to the paper started by Lenin at the turn of the previous century. And the paper really attempted to sort of popularize ideas of Marx and Lenin, Frantz Fanon, the Amir Cabral, who was a Marxist in Guinea-Bissau, I won't have time to talk about, and really tried to create sort of a sort of hub of sort of revolutionary left thinking on campus. And part of that was a very rigorous sort of intellectual training. And I gave an example in the packet of one of their study, one of their sort of sets of study groups that you can see there, and the kind of readings that they did. And I included this just because I think, I mean, maybe this is obvious to a lot of people, but I don't think it's necessarily obvious in the US that there is this very kind of rigorous intellectual kind of Marxist training that people did in Africa and continue to do to this day, and that people read very widely throughout from different, drawing from different aspects of the revolutionary Marxist tradition, and really sort of made it a project of themselves to really train themselves as a revolutionary left. And so this organization, the African Revolutionary Front, organizes a number of different actions that sort of challenge a lot of the limitations of what was happening on campus in terms of it really being a campus that was going to really promote sort of African, even African socialism. And what this student group did that I think was so interesting is that they didn't emerge as sort of just an opposition to Nyerere. In many ways, they sort of saw themselves as sort of a critique within kind of Nyerere's project. They would go to Ujamaa villages. They would look at what was going on. They'd work there. And they would sort of come back and say, here's what we think is not working right about them, and here's what we think are the limitations. They actually went out and did research on these nationalized corporations, and what they discovered was that, in fact, these nationalized companies and the banks the managing of them had been reassigned under management contracts to other multinational Western banks. And so they were national sort of in name, but actually continued to being run by foreign banks. And they wrote an expose on this that really sort of blew up in Tanzania. And what they started to recognize that really kind of flew in the face of sort of African socialist thinking was that it was not true that there were not sort of class divides in Africa. And this had been the sort of key argument of people like Nyerere, that not only had there not been class divides before colonial rule, but in fact, even colonial rule itself had not actually created substantial class divides in Africa. And I can talk more about why that argument was taking place, but the African Revolutionary Front on campus really began to make this argument that that's not actually the case. That here in Tanzania, but really all over Africa, there has been a class that has come out of sort of the new leadership of the state that has actually enriched itself off the backs of the various nationalizations, of putting themselves in charge of new state industries and new state factories, and that actually there's a class struggle that is not just between the rich countries and the poor countries anymore, but actually has to be a class struggle within African countries as well. And that was a big shift, and this shift is, I think, happening across Africa in 1968, in a lot of places, including even those like Tanzania that had seemingly the most sort of radical visions of African socialism. And so in response to these sorts of critiques and a lot of the actions of students, the newspaper is banned. Cheche is banned, the organization is banned. But it actually has a very strong influence in the long term, not even long term, but actually in the short term, even after it's banned, which is that this left pressure from the people around Cheche and the African Revolutionary Front leads to a sort of new set of party guidelines, not for the Revolutionary Front, but for the single party state for Nyerere's party in 1971. And one of these guidelines, in response to the critiques of the Revolutionary Front, is that power should be transferred to the people, and that workers should have more of an active role in running the factories that had been nationalized and the companies that have been created as new state industries. But rather than doing it through the organization of the party, workers in these state factories responded to this by going out on strike and saying, you're right, we should be running things, and we're not. If this is socialism, we should be running it. And so there was a series of strikes following 1968. There were 31 wildcat strikes. Strikes were illegal. Trade unions were actually illegal, right? This is sort of the contradictions, right, of the African socialist model. But there was sort of they called them downing of tools, since they weren't technically allowed to strike. There were 31 sort of downing of tools involving 30,000 workers in Tanzania, which was actually a huge amount in a country that did not have a very big industrial working class. And it just sort of blew open the doors, I think, in a lot of ways on sort of the limits of African socialism and its contradictions. And again, as in Senegal, it didn't. You know, Naira was eventually able to sort of force the workers back into the factories, but there was a big kind of political opening that could never kind of be closed again. And I think that really across Africa in 1968, that's what these struggles did in a lot of places that were again sort of dominated by these single party states, which is that the opposition sort of broke out in such a way that could never kind of be contained in the same way. So I just want to conclude. And thank you, Akuna, for being so patient, and everyone out there. I want to conclude with just sort of drawing a couple of kind of common threads from different things that were happening in 68, including some of the examples that I didn't get to talk about. But one is just the importance of student organizations and work organizations, whether they be official trade unions or, in the case of Tanzania, essentially workers organizing without a trade union. But how important they were in the context of these single party states, where there was no space in sort of what you could call formal politics to kind of absorb popular grievances. Students and workers, because they were organized at their sites of work, but also students because they were often sort of organized within the sort of space of a campus, when they began to sort of push against the limitations of what formal independence meant, or even what African socialism was bringing to the table, they became these kind of poles of attraction for all kinds of other grievances from society. And so that's why a lot of these struggles become so explosive. That's why 50 students at the University of Dar es Salaam can provoke a two-year set of wildcat strikes involving 30,000 workers. That's why students going out at the University of Dakar can actually provoke a general strike that nearly topples the government. And so, again, I think it's important to remember that, and I think it's important to remember that today as well. That actually, a lot of times, although the African working class remains quite small, it actually continues to be this place around which there's a great deal of organization and a great deal of sort of leadership, I think, being provided around a whole number of sort of grievances and struggles in society more generally. The other sort of thread that I think is important from all this is the importance of Marxist organizations, and often very small under conditions of very extreme repression. But how important it was for his groups like that core of 20 people in the Congolese Revolution, the Party of African Independence students at the University of Dakar, the African Revolutionary Front in Tanzania, that these groups, in a situation where mass struggles broke out, could actually play a very important role, sort of disproportionate to their numbers. And that's not in any ways an argument against building larger socialist organization, and that would have been actually incredibly important had it been sort of possible at the time. In many ways, because of repression, it was simply not. But nevertheless, how important it was to actually have those core of Marxists who had done that sort of rigorous kind of intellectual training to really think about sort of how to talk to people, what were the sort of questions of the day, how to organize, how to write a pamphlet, all those things were so important. And the last thing about that I think is sort of an important common thread is this issue that actually these kind of state development plans that were top down, that were really about sort of trying to kind of speed up capitalist development, but in the name of sort of redistributing and wealth and bringing socialism, that there were major contradictions and limitations to those that we have to be very honest about, as much as I think people like Nkrumah and Nyerere and Nasser, you know, remain these sort of iconic figures and really important in terms of what they contributed to us around the need to combat imperialism on a global scale, the importance of Pan-Africanism. Still, I think we have to recognize the concrete limitations of what they were, of what their actual programs were. And I think that in 1968, that's exactly what a lot of working people and a lot of young people in Africa were coming up against, were precisely those limitations. And there was a real search for a sort of revolutionary Marxism that didn't just rely on having to sort of be able to compete with the sort of former colonial powers on a capitalist market, and to really kind of democratize what those discussions about what the socialist future of Africa were going to be about. And I think that's sort of the big kind of takeaway about why 1968 was so important in Africa. So I'll stop there.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.